Welcome to Garden Talk on WPR. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for spending some of your time with us today. And we got a great guest for you. Lindsay Hendricks is back. She is the horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And Lindsay's going to review how to get the most out of your summer annuals. And of course, we'll take your gardening questions as we move along today. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Lindsay, welcome back to Garden Talk.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me again. I'm excited to be back.
You know, I was sitting on my front porch not that long ago, sort of admiring the flowers and so forth that I have out growing out in front of the house, and one of the neighbors stopped by and said, what have you got in here? I said, I got some annuals and some perennials in here, and started pointing some of them out. He said, what really is the difference between an annual and a perennial? He said, it's confusing. And I said, well, it can be, because something that's a perennial in Georgia might be an annual here.
Yeah, exactly. That's probably one of our number one questions at the garden, is how to know the difference and what's hardy here. You know, because like you said, some things that are grown farther south, we treat as annuals. So, you know, at the garden, we have a lot of perennials, trees and shrubs, but we also have a lot of annuals. We grow over 20,000 annuals every year that we add to our garden. So kind of a quick way for guests to know at our garden what is an annual or not is we have two different types of display labels. So one of them is an aluminum label that permanently stays in the garden. Those are your trees and shrubs and perennials. And then our annual labels, are printed on paper and laminated, and they're a special little holder, and they're really shiny, so they kind of stand out. So that's an easy way for guests at the garden to know what's an annual or not when they come to visit.
You know, for me, the annuals, my front lawn area there and the path, or the distance between the sidewalk and the street, there's a lot of perennials in there. And so, and it's shady. So I don't get a lot of color early on. So I like to get some annuals in there just to give me some color. Is that the main reason why we put them in?
Yeah, there's probably the number one reason that, you know, a lot of people choose annuals is because they produce a lot of flowers and a lot of color throughout the season when they're growing. So especially in the shady areas where not a lot is growing or blooming, you know, that's one of our favorite places here to add annuals in, to add a little splash of color. So, you know, that's the great thing about them. They bloom pretty much the whole entire season. Give them some water and Miracle-Gro and they'll be good to go.
Yeah. So is that how you get the most out of your summer annuals investment?
Yeah, at the garden, thankfully, we've been pretty lucky this year. We've gotten lots of rain, so we haven't had to water a lot. But, you know, typically when you're having annuals in the ground or in a container, they need about an inch of water a week to grow successfully. So keeping them hydrated, checking them for water regularly, especially if they're in a container or a pot. And then because they throw out so many blooms and are, you know, putting on a show all summer, is they need a little extra nutrition. So we used to use Miracle-Gro, you know, the blue stuff that looks like blue Gatorade, give that to them about once a week or twice every other week. Then we switched to an organic version of the Miracle-Gro that was water soluble, but we found that that wasn't as effective to getting our plants growing really well, because, you know, we have a pretty short growing season here in Wisconsin. Up in Green Bay, it's about like 3 or 4 months. So we want things to look really good really fast. So this year we kind of switched things up and tried something a little different. When we planted all of our annuals in our garden, we kind of top dressed with a little bit of Osmocote, which is a slow release fertilizer around the base of all those annuals. So then every time it rains or every time that we water, those nutrients are going down to the roots of the plant, so we don't have to spend extra time fertilizing outside of watering. And it seems to be doing a really good job this year. So we're kind of excited how great things are looking already in the season.
Well, most of your plants are in the ground, but you do have a lot of pots, and I have a fair number of pots myself. I've got some annuals in the ground and some in pots. I'm wondering about replacing soil in those pots. You got a lot of replacement going on there.
Oh, yes. We have lots of pots here at the garden. I don't even want to know how many we have. Some areas have almost a dozen or so, but it kind of depends on the size of the pot. Some of our smaller pots that are about like 10 to 12, maybe even 14 inches or so at the end of the season when we're pulling out our annuals, a lot of times all that soil is just pure roots, so that just goes into our compost pile. And if there is any loose soil in there, we have a stash of, we call reused soilless media that we kind of save from year to year. But some of our bigger pots, you know, the really big tall ones that are a couple feet tall and wide, we don't empty those out every year because that would be a lot of soilless media to have to replace, and that gets pretty expensive. So we usually remove the top couple inches or so, 10 or 12 inches or so, or maybe a little bit more if the pot's really heavy. And then we put that extra soil in our little pile that we keep off to the side. And then in spring, when it's time to pot things up again, we will add new soilless media with a little bit of Osmocote mixed in to the top of all the pots. And we kind of mix it in with the existing soil just to give, incorporate it a little bit more. And then for our smaller pots, we put brand new soil in there because it's got a little bit more nutrition. But, you know, you don't have to replace the new soil every year. You can reuse some of the other stuff. It's a little bit more sustainable and economical. And a lot of times the annuals that we have planted in there, you know, the roots only go down, you know, like a couple inches or maybe like a foot or so. The bigger tropicals like cannas and elephant ears will go down a little bit deeper, but generally the bottom of the pot is just soilless media that's holding on to water, and not a lot's going on down there.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. We did get a question and an email question that has to do with lilac trees, and I'd probably worth bringing up here because it might be an issue that others are having. Karen emailed, "The leaves on her lilac tree are turning brown and falling off already. Seems to have some white and some yellow colored spots on the bark. Karen's guessing this is due to all the rain we've gotten. I'm wondering if you agree with that. And if so, what can she do to bring it back to good health?" And the rain would have an effect. You know, you get some bacterial blight in there for one thing.
Yeah, for sure. Like, definitely, I'm going to say the rain probably has a lot to do with that. We've noticed, not so much in our lilacs here, but especially like our crab apples, the rust is really prolific this year, so leaves are dropping. But I would assume with the lilac, because depending on the cultivar, some of the older ones are more susceptible to powdery mildew. And a lot of times if plants get powdery mildew, the leaves will turn kind of yellow, eventually brown, and then they will fall off. And depending on the timing of the year, if it's earlier in the season, sometimes they will flush out new foliage and replace those leaves, or the new growth that grows throughout the season, you know, should be a little bit more resilient and not as effective. There are different, you know, fungicides that you can apply to the trees to help prevent the lilac from, you know, developing powdery mildew. But once, you know, you have a significant amount of leaves falling off your tree, you know, you can't really make it grow new foliage and be all lush and green again. So being proactive about it, you know, making sure you're pruning in the dormant season, you know, to kind of clear up the interior of your trees, removing dead crossing branches, because better air circulation will kind of help prevent those diseases from coming back, you know, the following year.
Going back to annuals, John wonders about the benefits of fertilizing annuals, which you mentioned, but also for a quality fertilizer, what ingredients do you look for in a quality fertilizer?
Well, that's a good question. So, you know, like I said, the annuals need a lot of nutrition to help them bloom throughout the season. So there's so many different fertilizers out there these days. It's kind of hard to tell which one is the best. There's water soluble that, you know, you mix with your watering can, you know, is really quickly taken up by the plants. And then there's the slow release like Osmocote, which you apply once and then it slowly releases throughout the season. So, you know, there's that thing called the NPK ratio or the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium ratio in the fertilizers. And just about everyone that you get is going to have a different number. So, you know, typically you, like your general annual plants, you probably want to have something where your NPKs are kind of consistent, or the numbers are all kind of similar, the same, because that means you can use it for, you know, pretty much all of your plants and they'll all get some nutrition. But if you have something that's really high in nitrogen, the N, that's going to force or encourage the plants to put out a lot of really green, lush growth. So it might be good for your lawn if you fertilize your lawn, but probably not so good for your annual plants because they're going to put more energy into producing leaves than flowers. So, you know, and the phosphorus, which is the second number, that's what goes towards the flower production of your plants and root and shoot growth. So, you know, if you have that number a little bit of higher, you know, that is good for plants that are going to be flowering a lot. And, you know, like roses might have different nutrition requirements. And then, you know, vegetables probably a little bit different too. So, you know, I don't really have like a good answer for you because there's so many options out there. Yeah. And depending on like your overall, I guess, end goal of what you're trying to encourage and what plant, you know, that's kind of the best I can do. You can like look it up too online and be like, hey, I have a citrus tree. What kind of fertilizer is best? You know, usually something a little bit more acidic, but what NPK number should I be looking for?
Yeah. When it comes to annuals, I guess we want them to bloom longer than the neighbors.
Yeah, for sure. So usually like the Miracle-Gro, the blue stuff that you get, you know, we were using that for quite a few years and that's pretty readily commonly available, you know, and that always did really well for us. So, you know, something that's pretty much along those lines is, you know, pretty good for just about everything.
Can you encourage your annuals to reseed themselves naturally?
You can, and that actually brings up a good point, Larry, because one of the things about keeping your annuals looking good is, you know, they bloom, but once those blooms are spent, you know, what do you do? Because sometimes those flower heads don't look very good. So a lot of times at the garden, we will deadhead or remove the spent blooms because then the plant is putting more energy back into producing more flowers and keeping going throughout the season. But however, in the cottage garden, and that's kind of one of the philosophies of cottage gardening is saving seeds. And even homeowners who like to save seeds, save a little money, and just kind of keep the same plant going in their yard, you know, that's pretty easy to do with annuals. You just don't deadhead them. So usually in the cottage in the early part of the season, I kind of keep things deadheaded because I want them to keep blooming throughout the year. And some plants, once they start producing seed, will stop blooming altogether. But usually around August, I'll stop deadheading some of the things I like to save seed for. I've started doing zinnias the last couple years. You can do cosmos. I do the annual bread seed poppies are one of the really big things that I save because we have such a cool collection of colors. So, you know, it's worth saying though that some annual plants that are hybridized and only propagated vegetatively through cuttings where you have to buy them as a plant or a plug before you plant them. Those either won't produce seed or their seed isn't viable. So it's kind of good to know what you're growing and if it's worth trying to save seed or not too, because there's a lot of things out there now. And again, I can't name everything because there's so much out there. You know, you'd kind of have to know what you're working with and look it up online to see if it's viable seed or not. But there's a lot of old-fashioned heirloomy plants that you start from seed. If it's anything that started from seed, you can save seed from it. But if it started as a plug or a plant, it might be less likely that you can reproduce using seed.
Lindsay Hendricks, our guest today, horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. You can join in too. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Coming up after 12:30 today, you will get a behind-the-scenes look at a mushroom farms and hear how you can grow your own fungi. That's coming up at 12:30. Right now, though, we're talking about flowers today, perennials and annuals. Mostly, we've been talking annuals with our guest, Lindsay Hendricks. And you can join in, again, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. I'm wondering on annuals, are there some that are, you know, require less water, let's say? If, you know, people go off on vacation and you're don't always, in fact, this afternoon, I think I'm going to have to water my pots because they're drying out even after all the rain we've had. I've hardly had to water all spring.
Yeah, we have a lot of variety of plantings here at the garden, but at home, I don't like to water because I'm so exhausted sometimes. Yeah. By the time I get home, I don't want to take care of my plants. So I try to plant more things that are a little bit more drought tolerant, so they require less attention. But this year, with all the rain we've been getting, some of them are a little more finicky, so I've had to kind of hide them underneath the overhangs in my house. But one thing that's pretty popular that I have a lot of people that I know do are succulents and even cacti, because those are very, they don't like to be wet, and they're pretty easy to maintain. Unfortunately, not all of them are hardy to, our Wisconsin winter. So you have to bring them inside for the, winter, or you can throw them out, give them to a friend. But something, flowers I really like. Geraniums are pretty, they like it on the drier side. Dusty millers, vincas, different verbenas, and there's probably other things out there that we have that I'm just not thinking of right now. But my favorites are probably like vincas, verbenas, and I really love geraniums, especially in the cottage garden. I have a ton of different, there's scented geraniums, so many different colors, leaf colorations, and those add a little different texture and colored foliage too, besides the different blooms that they have. And a lot of those things are available in a lot of different colors as well.
During our short break, I showed you a picture of what my front house looks like right now.
Yeah.
But you didn't see many of the annuals there, but they are there. I love pansies, which there are so many kinds, and I've got the lavender pansy out there. I've got some with the and some stars and pink stars, and they're just beautiful to have kind of where the daylilies are, because they give me some color until the daylilies come. So that's something that I kind of like to do, and I really enjoy them. Rona in Hayden, though, has a question for you, so I want to go there. Rona, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Rona.
Hi. I'm so excited to hear this program. I'm on my way into Green Bay right now, and I didn't even realize there was a botanical garden there.
Yes, stop and visit us, please. It's awesome.
So I'm wondering what the hours are and if there's any special exhibits that we want to make sure we see. Thank you.
Awesome. Well, are you coming into Green Bay tonight?
I think they're coming.
Yeah, we'll be there tonight. We'll be there in about an hour, actually.
Oh, perfect. Well, we have actually our hours for this time of the year are 9 a.m. to 8 p.m. Monday through Sunday. So we're open every day of the week in the summer, even on holidays. So, but we do have this weekend today actually is a concert. It's called Divas of Soul. It's a Whitney Houston, Tina Turner tribute. I don't think it's sold out, so you might be able to get tickets for that. But we have a lot of concerts throughout the summer months on Thursdays and Fridays. I think we have, that's probably the only thing we have going on this weekend here, but we do have our Bell Children's Garden. If I'm not sure if you have kids or not, but that's a pretty popular place this summer. We have a splash pad and a little rain garden that has some water features that go in it. So it's pretty popular with the kids. But we also have, you know, usually with our concerts, we have Discovery Station set up where there's our education department has a little booth, and then they usually have some sort of project and educational component. I'm not sure what tonight's is. Usually for our concerts, we have a thing called Seeds to Snacks where we pick something from the garden and then our education team like makes something, and then guests can kind of help make it and, you know, sample some of those things. So, you know, our biggest thing right now is probably our concerts, you know, throughout the summer, Thursdays and Fridays. And then we have the Bell Children's Garden as kind of still our exhibit. It just opened up last year, but we're still kind of riding the high on like seeing the increase in attendance numbers down there. But, you know, if you want to come back next year, it's not 100% set in stone, but I was allowed to tease about it, is we're bringing back our Washed Ashore exhibit to the Green Bay Botanical Garden. And I think, it was probably 4, 5, or 6 years ago we had it the first time, and it was pretty popular. So check out our website otherwise. That has everything posted on there, what's going on this weekend and, you know, throughout the summer.
But the flower, I mean, the various areas, I've been there many times. I mean, Rona, you would get to see a heck of a lot of flowers in a variety of circumstances, frankly.
Yeah, for sure. We definitely have a ton blooming all over the place. We're about 2 to 3 weeks ahead of our normal schedule because of the mild winter and the early spring and all the rain. So things are looking really big and bold and beautiful right now. So we're pretty excited.
It's kind of maybe a quick history of the garden, when it was created and so forth. It goes back a ways.
Yeah, good quizzing on me today, Larry. usually I don't give those tours that tell about the history of the garden, but I've heard a lot of them and been here long enough. So the Green Bay Botanical Garden, I believe we opened to the public in 1995 or 1996. There were a group of people in Green Bay at the time that thought Green Bay should have a botanical garden. So the vision kind of came around a little bit before we were open to the public, and it took quite a while to raise the money, you know, and start construction. So we are a 501c nonprofit. So, you know, the majority of our income comes from donations, admissions, different events that we have throughout the season. So, you know, we were, I forget how much acreage we had when we started, but, you know, it was a decent garden, but pretty much, at least since I've been here and since 2010, and even before that, you know, we've been adding on, developing new gardens, more areas, different types of gardens, structures, you know, just about everything. So we are now about, I think we're around 47 acres total, and over half of that is developed into gardens right now. And we have a really cool partnership with Northeast Wisconsin Technical College, who they are our landlords, and we pay them $1 a year for our lease. It's a 100-year lease, so we got quite a ways to go, and it's pretty cheap rent. But, you know, we have a good relationship with them where their staff and students can get admission to the garden for free. And their landscape horticulture program, unfortunately, is no longer at the school because of low attendance numbers. But their students used to use the garden as a living classroom to learn plants and see how plants grow. And their building, their school, was actually on the garden ground. So that, I think we're the only botanical garden in the state of Wisconsin, or maybe probably not the country, but that had like a college university on its campus that uses, you know, the gardens as a living classroom. So we still have the relationship with them. They help us out with a lot of different projects and events. They have students that come out to help us set up for Garden of Lights and, you know, help us with a lot of just facilities, things that we have. And they use it as a learning opportunity. So, you know, we have a lot of really great families in the garden or in the community that are very kind to the garden. You know, we have different additions, you know, and fundraising opportunities. So we wouldn't be able to do it without them. But, you know, we have a lot of great members and community members that come out and support us as well. So, and lots of volunteers that help us do just about everything. So want to give a shout out to them because we wouldn't be able to do anything without them.
Yeah. You got me thinking back because when their fundraising was going on to get the garden going, I was asked to be a banquet speaker.
Oh, nice.
For one of the big fundraisers, and I was amazed at the number of people who showed up. Lots of people were interested in getting it going, and I knew then that you were going to have a great place someday, and it certainly turned into that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for getting us going, Larry. And I mean, considering
it's a small help.
yeah. But we do have a great community support. We're a pretty small, you know, population compared to some of these bigger gardens. And, you know, we wouldn't be able to do it without our community.
Got a number of questions here. One question was from Samantha in Whitehall. She's wondering if annuals will last all year if you plant them in a pot in your house.
Well, it's possible, but it kind of depends on the annual, because most annuals are called that because they have an annual life cycle, which means they start from seed, they grow, they flower, produce seed, and then they die. So if you have something like a zinnia and you plant that in a pot, probably not going to like it too much in your house anyways, but you know, once it kind of is done blooming, it's probably going to die back. But if you have something that's a little bit more, you know, something that can be grown as a tropical farther south that will grow year round, like geraniums, sometimes coleus, different sedums, begonias, and there's quite a few other plants, mostly ones that are shade tolerant or foliage plants, like different ferns and stuff too, you know, palm trees and all that stuff you can get at, you know, Home Depot and their like interior department. So there are quite a few that are, but if it's something that started from seed and does a lot of blooming in the summer and then it kind of fizzles out, you know, by the end of the season, that might not be, you know, the best option. So you can check the plant tag and the zone to see what zone it is, you know, and that'll kind of help guide you to what to pick.
You did mention geraniums, and before we go to John in Mount Horeb, I did want to bring in from Jill, who wants your thoughts on deadheading geraniums. She's heard both ways.
Yes, well, I guess it's a good point. Do I mean the annual geranium or the perennial geranium? So the annual geraniums, I like to keep them deadheaded because sometimes their seed heads afterwards aren't very attractive and it takes away from the rest of your plant. So usually once the flowers start turning brown and crispy, or if you get a heavy rainstorm and they just kind of all mush together, I remove it just so it can put more energy into more blooms. You know, it's kind of a personal preference too. If you like looking at it without being deadheaded, by all means, you know, don't do it. But the perennial geraniums that are, their name is geranium, genus, whatever the species may be, you know, those don't necessarily need to be deadheaded. We don't really do that here at the garden, but some of the ones that are a little more obnoxious and grow all over the place. We do sometimes give them a little bit of a haircut to keep them from sprawling over some of the other plants that are growing around them, or sometimes they just splay open in the middle of the season and get kind of flattened out. We'll kind of trim them back to encourage a flush of new growth and some more bloom. So it's kind of up to you on how you want them to look in your garden, but I like to keep mine deadheaded.
Yeah, and when you're talking about deadheading, what does that involve? Does that involve, somebody here wants to know, snipping them off, or do you just kind of try and pull them?
Yeah, it kind of depends on the plant. I like to use a little clippers. You can use a pruners, but I have a really small like pruning scissors almost that's really sharp and has a smaller tip that can get into your plants without destroying anything. So I like to use those, and when you're removing a spent flower bloom, I like to take it back to either a set of leaves or the next little like bud that's starting to like push out that will bloom, because it just looks better for the form of the plant.
Sure.
Some people will just take off the spent bloom and then they leave like that little stalk behind it, which to me looks kind of weird. You have all these weird little spikes with nothing on them. So I like to take them back to a set of leaves or the next bloom that's going to be flowering. But there are some things that are, you know, really supple, lush foliage plants that you can just pinch with your fingers, especially if you have really sharp fingernails, which I don't because they keep dirt underneath them. So my fingernails are pretty short. But like coleus, a lot of coleus will eventually bloom, and a lot of people don't like that look. So that's something that's really easy. You can just take your fingers and pinch that flower off back to the next set of leaves. You know, some marigolds, you can do that too as well, but it kind of depends on the plant. I like to use my little pruning shears, garden scissors, because then I don't risk damaging, you know, the rest of my plant. Because sometimes you pull too hard, you snap off the stem, and then you're kind of wishing you wouldn't have done that. So,
yeah.
Again, personal preference, but I like to use my little scissors because then I know I'm going to cut and not damage my plant.
Yeah, I've done the other. It doesn't,
yeah.
It's not, not pretty sometimes.
No.
Let's go to John in Mount Horeb. Hi, John. Thank you for waiting.
Yes, thank you. Hey, we have a question about tomatoes. And what we have is we have tomatoes in pots on our deck. They're getting lots of sun, and we're getting lots of beautiful green vegetation, but very few blooms and no miniature tomatoes at all yet.
And my wife
is here.
There's a couple on one, but not much.
What do we need to do to get tomatoes instead of just fish?
Probably got a lot of nitrogen.
Yeah, that's what I'm guessing. You probably maybe used a fertilizer inadvertently that had a lot of nitrogen on it. But you said it gets full sun?
Is it getting full?
Yes, they are getting full.
They are getting full sun.
Okay.
They're getting full sun, so
okay.
What do you think? Is there a time yet to put some heavier phosphorus or?
Yeah, it probably could use some fertilizer, but if you have flowers on it, the tomatoes, that means the tomatoes are coming. So different tomato varieties bloom and fruit and ripen earlier than others. So depending on which variety you might have, you might be in the boat where it's a little bit on the later blooming side, but typically stuff in pots is pretty quick to grow and put on fruit. So
to some extent, it depends on, and we lost John, we're having some trouble with John,
yeah.
But it depends a lot on the tomato plant that you use. I mean, it's really good in my mind or my experience, if you're going to put it in a pot, you want a tomato that is designed to be put in a pot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Like we have, if I'm doing ones in pots, I try to do an indeterminate tomato, which is one that's not going to grow the size of a tree by the end of the season, because all the fruit will ripen at the same time, but you'll have something a little bit more manageable and it won't outgrow the space that it has. So, and usually those tomatoes will ripen faster than some of the indeterminate varieties, but I've grown some of the indeterminate types, especially the big beefsteak tomatoes. Those typically will mature and develop a little bit slower than something like a cherry or a grape tomato. So I know I'm guessing probably it's just the wrong type of the tomato for a pot. And, you know, too, depending on where you are and how hot it's been, you know, tomatoes like it really hot. So if it's been really wet and a little cooler, you know, they're not going to take off as fast as they would if it was like really hot, you know, and sunny. So kind of probably depends on the type of tomato, but, you know, kind of hard to say without seeing it as well.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Well, John, take a look at your variety too, but, you know, I just keep it going. You got a few, I mean, it's kind of late now to, in a way, to be starting over with tomatoes. So I would do the best I could with what I've got, I think.
Yeah. I mean, you can go to the store too and get a fertilizer. They do have a lot of fertilizer specifically for vegetables, and just pick one that's specifically for vegetables. And like Larry said, you know, with the potassium, that kind of promotes flower initiation. And if you get more flowers, then you get more fruit. And also pollinators, depending on when your tomatoes were blooming, if it was cold and rainy, pollinators might not have been around to pollinate your flowers. So hence you wouldn't get any fruit for that either.
Yeah. Look for that phosphorus number. For sure. Lindsay Hendricks, our guest today, horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Gardens. We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. And remember, we will be broadcasting live in Door County. Pretty near Lindsay, as a matter of fact, will be at Sister Bay at the Northern Sky Theater in Door County on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday. It's a live show. I think the doors open at 10:30. Tickets, it's a free event, but we do ask for tickets. You know, if you can, go to WPR.org and then go to the events page at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up on Monday on the program on the Larry Mueller Show, our physical therapists are back. They're going to be talking about the difference between doing physical therapy online versus in person. That's Monday at 11. Right now, it's Garden Talk with Lindsay Hendricks. Questions? Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Dean in Sturgeon Bay, we'll go to you. What's on your mind?
Well, Larry, I have a problem with my small plants just starting out, whether I have planted them from plant or seed, and they include cucumber, they include squash, and even beans. They seem to be eaten by something that I cannot see often before they develop a full set of four leaves.
So the leaves, do they look like they're being eaten, or...?
They start to look skeletonized, and that's in two different garden areas. And also, I put some in pots close to the house, and that was happening to those as well.
Okay. Lindsay, what do you think?
Well, if it's anything like my garden at home, you might have slugs. When you're planting things, are they like taking them down before they even have a chance to really grow? Or is it, you know, just kind of like little holes scattered throughout the leaves, or it's like full on skeletonization?
It's quite a bit of skeletonization, and some of the plants never are able to develop. I've tried rotenone on some of the plants that seem to knock them back. I call the insect flea beetles, just for lack of any term, because they seem to be so invisible. And I know they're not slugs. That seems to be happening when I can't see anything on the plant itself.
On the underside of the leaves, seeing anything?
No, I'm not seeing any, growth on the underside of the leaves. that would suggest there's something there.
Or sometimes those bugs are eating at night, too. You might even go out at night and take a look under the leaves at night with a flashlight, and you might see something.
Yeah, I know I can't at home. My peppers get decimated every year, and even the fruits get little holes in them. There's like these little black beetles. I don't know if they're like flea beetles or what, but that do attack. And, you know, you can spray stuff, but, you know, a lot of times you don't want to be doing that on your food. Even some of the organic products that are out there, I still don't like to do just because I don't want to be dealing with it or eating that food. But, you know, you can, like, put little, netting over some of your plants to kind of deter things from getting on them. But then, you know, if you need your flowers pollinated to produce fruit, that kind of prevents that from happening as well. So the other thing, Dean, I know here at the garden they've showed up, and they also do a lot of damage in the garden, especially veggies, like are the Japanese beetles. They do a lot of skeletonization, but typically you will see them around during the day. They're those like big black shiny beetles that just kind of cover everything. So, but if you're not seeing those around, like Larry said, you might want to go out at night with a flashlight and just kind of see what you're seeing. Because there's a lot of different little bugs that will like chew on leaves of plants.
And often at night.
Yeah. And I know like cucumbers too, and even squash, there's a thing, it's called a cucumber beetle. It's a little striped, yellow, orangey, black striped beetle that goes into the flowers of those crops. And it will basically destroy the flowers so you don't get any fruit, but they will also attack the leaves and go after the leaves and kind of like make them brown up and yellow up to the point where they basically fall off and your plant can't grow. So I know we've had those bad here before, and that's kind of taken out some of those crops. So if you're not like seeing it, it's kind of hard to say exactly what it is, but you might just want to get a flashlight and some detective, microscope or the lens and go out there and look to see if you can see any actual critter evidence.
Yeah, and if you can do that, then if it's a bug, an insect, if you can describe it, send a note to the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab, and they can probably give you a pretty quick answer, Dean. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Perry in Oconto will go to you. Hi, Perry.
Yes, this is more along the lines of houseplants. But any recommendation for cleaning the leaves of your plant other than just taking a damp towel and wiping it?
Well, depending on your plant and how many you have, I've heard of some of our staff, they just put all their plants in their bathtub or shower and turn on the shower and kind of rinse them off that way, especially if they get kind of dusty. That's probably the easiest way to do it. And then the water will kind of increase the humidity around those plants, and then typically you kind of let them in there till they dry off. Most interior plants like it a little bit more humid, especially if they're like tropical nature, so they might appreciate that. But if you have cacti and succulents, are probably not going to be cleaning off the leaves very much anyways, but you'd have to make sure it's a plant that can handle a little bit more water. But usually if I just have a couple of them, I'll just throw them in my sink and turn on some water on a gentle stream. Make sure it's not too hot or too cold so you don't shock your plant. Kind of tepid water temperature is probably the best for them so you don't hurt the foliage. But there are products that you can spray on the leaves. I think most you have to wipe off, but I don't like to encourage the use of those because sometimes they can plug up the little like lenticels and breathing structures of the leaves, so then they can't transpire as efficiently as they should. So sometimes it can actually be like bad for your plants. They look nice and shiny, but they don't really breathe as well. So I would throw them in your sink or in your shower, rinse them off, let them dry off, and should probably do the trick, I would think.
There you go, Perry. Thank you. John in Port Wing, your turn. Hi, John.
Yeah, I've got a question about a perennial that we have here that supposedly shouldn't even grow here. It's a buddleia, butterfly bush.
Yep.
and I want to transplant it, and just basically to raise the elevation, not particularly move it, because it seems to do real well in the location it's at. What kind of a root system am I going to be dealing with?
Well, we have a couple. Those are one of those things where I know our zones are changing and being a little bit more on the warmer end of things. So more of them are perennial in nature, especially up in Green Bay now. So they don't have like a deep tap root. It's probably more of like a fibrous root system. But you definitely, you know, we always suggest, unless it's absolutely necessary, to transplant any perennial or tree or shrub in the season opposite of bloom. So right now our butterfly bushes are just starting to bloom, so you definitely don't want to move it now. Otherwise you risk, losing the flowers, and it can stress out the plant if it's trying to put energy into blooming and then also recovering from transplant. So my suggestion, like when to do it, would be either early in the spring, kind of when they start coming back growing, or in the fall after they're done blooming. So, you know, just make sure before you move it that you, if we're not getting a lot of rain, that you kind of water it in good about the day before you transplant it, so it's less likely to get shock. And then just make sure you have a big enough shovel and you dig far enough away from the roots that you get as much of the root mass as possible, and try not to, you know, knock a lot of the soil off so it doesn't get shocked. And then once you kind of relocate it or adjust it where you want it to be, you know, just make sure you're keeping it well watered so it doesn't dry out and stress out. So I don't know if that answered
all good
your
tips.
Question.
I think it's all good tips. I mean, it likes it where it is. You know, it's doing really well where it is, John. So, I'm always leery about moving, but you're keeping it in the same spot. So maybe if you wait till after the flowering is over, you could give it a shot. Good luck. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Miles on Highway 29, your turn. Hi, Miles.
Hey, hi. Highway 29. I live in Rhinelander, and the previous owner of my house is a master gardener and planted the boulevard. And I've got more and more of these very tall, thick-stemmed plants growing that have leaves about the size of my hand. And at the stem, they cup and collect water. And I'm wondering, is that something I want growing there? I have no idea what it is. Nothing's growing.
I know what
yet.
That is. I'm guessing pretty much 100% once you said the leaves cup at the stem, that is called cup plant, which is a native plant that are typically, well, can be planted in a lot of native plantings, you know, in different locations. So depending on your house and the space that you have and what you want it to do, you know, they can be a little, I don't want to say aggressive, but they're more on the sides of very prolific. So they will seed out as well. So if you want one of the plants, you know, you can let it go. But if you don't want it to take over, you might have to selectively remove them from your landscape. Because if you just kind of let them do your thing, they can outcompete a lot of the other plants that may be either in that boulevard or in your yard. So you kind of have to decide, you know, if you want it, make sure you keep it in check by, you know, pulling out the seedlings that come up or removing the spent bloom so it doesn't seed and spread. Or if you're okay with it kind of, you know, just doing what it wants to do, you know, that's kind of up to you. But it can, you know, they can move around a lot and outcompete other things that you might want to keep in your yard or in the boulevard planting. So don't be afraid to pull any out if it starts to spread.
Yeah. I was thinking about my Shasta daisies, which I have been, they're bullies. They can be bullies and take over everything. And I'm going to have to do a little digging up. I know there's some neighbors that want some, so I'm going to be moving them, and I've done that before, and I'll do it again. Our guest today, Lindsay Hendricks, horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. She'll be with us right up until 12:30. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Lindsay Hendricks, horticulture manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Great to have her with us. And lots of callers online. Let's go to the phones right off the bat here with Doug in Green Bay. Thank you for calling, Doug.
Yes, this is Doug.
Yeah, what's...
got a call here. Yes, actually, Rice Lake area on 29, watching Ryan, who's in front of us on 29. Looking for perennials, looking for shady type plants, and we have a lot of hostas, but we want to increase our varieties.
Okay, something besides hostas, you're saying, Doug?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. I'm assuming you're looking to probably add a little bit of color.
That's my guess. Yeah, that's okay. My guess.
Okay. If you want to stick with perennials, there's a lot of options out there. I mean, first of all, come to the Green Bay Botanical Garden and check out our King Shade Garden, which has a ton of different hostas, but also a lot of different perennials mixed in. But probably a pretty popular one that we've been using, and we actually started using in containers a lot, are coral bells or hookra. There's hundreds of different color combinations, colored leaves, flowers, to add a little splash of color next to your hostas. So it's not just green shades of like pinks and reds and purples, silvers. Those are really pretty. Astilbes are pretty cool. I really like those. They usually get a flower stalk kind of around this time of the year, different colors of whites and pinks and reds, and everything in between. And then foliage is kind of a different texture foliage of the hostas, where it's a little more kind of fern leaf like, lace like, depending on the variety. It also comes in like shades of greens, purples, bronzes. There's this really cool one I really love. It's called Dark Side of the Moon. It's the first purple leafed astilbe with like a hot pink flower. Have some at home. They're just about ready to bloom. I'm really excited. There's lots of different, like Jacob's ladder, pulmonaria is like a different color, different textured foliage, different colors as well, variegated and green and like purpley flowers typically. So if you're in the Green Bay area, I'm going to put a plug out to Rose Hill Gardens. That's my favorite place to go for unique perennials, especially shade ones. He has a lot of really great hosta varieties, but also coral bells, astilbes, and other shade-loving plants. So,
lots of good tips there. Dave in Appleton, what's on your mind?
Yes, I've got a couple of questions, if I may. One of them is on comfrey. I love the plant, but a word to the wise. You better plant it where you're going to want it for life, because it seems when you try to move it, it just keeps coming back. And with making tea with comfrey to use, do you have to dilute it? So that's one question. The other one is, can you move flowering hollyhocks? Will they survive?
It's probably not a good idea on the hollyhocks, but
no, I wouldn't suggest it. Kind of going back to the perennials, in trees and shrubs, you typically don't want to move anything when it's blooming, because that's going to add extra stress to the plant, especially during the summer months when it can be really hot and maybe droughty. So I definitely wouldn't suggest that, but if you do decide to move it, I would remove the flower. So it's not going to put energy into trying to bloom and it can focus on new roots, but I would probably wait till it's done.
What about diluting? Dave wonders if you should dilute the comfrey.
Well, typically I'm not, haven't tried making tea with comfrey yet, so not an expert by any means, but typically if you're, like, are you using it to drink, or are you talking about like a compost tea sort of a thing?
Yeah, so it's a compost tea, but I am told that for some plants like tomatoes, you should dilute it. Other plants, I don't know, maybe you can put it on straight. It's very strong and very strong smelling. Sure.
So typically with like any sort of compost tea, we haven't used it here in the garden, but NWTC, their Sustainable Agriculture Department, uses compost tea, and they have a little agitator in their greenhouse that mixes it with water. Because you do want to dilute it. A lot of times those little teas are very concentrated, and if you apply them directly to the plants, they can be a little bit too strong and sometimes will burn your roots or even your leaves if it gets on it. So it depends on the strength. You know, the dilution ratio depends on the strength of the product, and unless you like test it, it's probably hard to know what the ratio is. But let's see, I just looked online quick because I was kind of interested in this. And it says, you know, if your tea is like thick and black, it says dilute one part of your tea to 20 parts water. And if it's thin and brown, dilute one part of your tea to 10 parts water.
That makes sense.
That helps. Yeah. So you definitely don't want to put it on there straight because that can be not good for your plants.
Dave, there you go. Thank you. Jody in Brooklyn, your turn. Hi, Jody.
Hi. My question is about the mildew that comes on black-eyed Susans. I started several in a probably 10 by 15 prairie garden type of garden, and of course they multiplied, and after the second or third year, there was one spot that had the mildew, and I read up on it, cut them down, and lo and behold, they come back next year even worse and in the same spot. So I know I need to thin them out, and I'm ultimately going to replace it with some flowers that aren't going to do that. But what do I do to get rid of it?
Mildew. Yeah, I think that's one of those things as gardeners, it'll get on just about everything, and we do whatever we can to try to prevent it. And then the next year it'll be on a different plant. So, you know, with all the rain we've been having this year, and then now that it's getting warmer and more humid, you know, that's like perfect conditions for powdery mildew. So, you know, like you said, dividing and thinning the plants that are getting affected, because, you know, better airflow, air circulation will kind of help decrease that. There are, you know, fungicide products that you can apply to kind of help keep it at bay, but, you know, then you have to keep up on it. But, you know, there are, if you really like the Rudbeckias, there are some varieties, newer varieties that are more resistant to the different mildews and like the fungal diseases that can make the leaves all like black and gross looking. So one of them that we have at the garden and has seemed pretty resistant to it is called American Gold Rush. It has, you know, excellent fungus resistant, you know, and it's also a good pollinator plant. So the leaves and flowers might be a little bit different than the ones you have, depending on the variety. But we do have it at the garden in some spots, and it has seemed to hold up a little bit, quite a bit better than the older cultivars that we have in some of the areas, which by August, all the leaves are black. You still have the flowers, but it doesn't look very nice. So, if you want to keep with the Rudbeckias, that's a cultivar I would try. But otherwise, you know, kind of thinning your population to increase airflow is probably your best bet. We can't control Mother Nature, unfortunately. So, you know, one of those things you kind of have to work around.
Jody, there you go. Thank you. Kathleen, who's on Interstate 90. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Better boys.
Planted in raised gardens. And foliage always gets just very, very heavy and thick. And I'm wondering if I should be pruning those tomato plants to help produce more fruit and kind of keep them in a little better condition.
Okay, so those better boys, we got really bushy plants and wondering if she should cut back some of those plants' stems to sort of increase production.
Yeah, I was just, I thank you, Larry, for that, because I was having a hard time hearing. I'm just looking to see if those are, you know, if that's like a cherry tomato.
No,
or like
they're, no? Okay. They're a large tomato.
Okay. I guess, let's see. It looks like it's an indeterminate variety. So my suggestion would be to prune it. I do that to all my tomatoes now, and they're a lot easier to kind of manage, and you can actually see what's growing. So I guess, you know, you can look up online for pictures and videos, but you know, the biggest thing is those indeterminate varieties will keep going and going and going, and they like to sucker a lot. And those little suckers, you know, probably called suckers because they suck, but they like will suck a lot of their nutrition and energy away from your plant. And instead of putting energy into fruit, it will put off energy into all this like new growth. So these suckers typically occur between the main stem and the set of leaves. It'll be like a little stem that kind of pops up and starts growing. When you see those, pinch them off or prune them off, because then your plant will direct all of its energy into the main stem and all your fruit. They can also get a lot of suckers around the base of your tomato plant. So when you plant it, you know, your main stem will start getting bigger and it'll keep going up. But any little plants around, or any little suckers that come up around that, I would just cut back towards the base of your plant. There's a little bit of like, you know, how much should you remove? How much shouldn't you? So you kind of have to kind of play around with it a little bit to see what works for you in your garden. But I found that removing suckers and around the base of the plant and between the leaves that come off has helped to minimize getting really unruly. You can usually around like August, I think, is when I do it. If your tomato gets like really, really tall, you can top them off. So then at the end of the season, instead of trying to produce more fruit and, you know, they can put all the energy into the plant, into the fruit that's already on your plant. So they ripen before the end of the season. So I would just, you know, look it up online for a video and some pictures if you haven't done it before. It's actually pretty easy once you know what you're doing, especially with those indeterminate varieties that take a while, or they grow like crazy, but the fruits are bigger and, you know, take a while to mature. So they can put energy into what you have instead of just trying to grow.
Kathleen, thank you for calling. Georgia in Cambridge, your turn. Hi, Georgia.
Hi. So I just have a comment to add to what was said to the gentleman who had tomatoes with flowers but no fruiting happening. And it's because my sister had the same problem. And she's not an experienced gardener. So she called me. And I asked her what was growing around the tomatoes. She had them on her deck. And I said, well, what's around the tomatoes? What flowers do you have nearby? And she said, well, no flowers. I don't have anything on the deck except the tomatoes. And I said, well, that might be the problem, because maybe the pollinators are not finding those little tiny tomato flowers in a place that doesn't have any gardens nearby. And she went and got some marigolds and potted them up, and pretty soon she started having tomatoes.
Georgia, thank you for calling. That's not bad advice, is it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the cottage garden, I have a lot of annuals around our tomato plants and at home too. And you know, like I said before, the pollinator thing, sometimes if you don't have the pollinators, you're not gonna, you know, get the fruit afterwards. So we're always promoting the use of pollinator plants and flowers here at the garden. So the more flowers you have on your patio, the prettier it is and the happier the pollinators are.
Absolutely. Thanks, Georgia. Appreciate the call. Dot in Chippewa Falls, we'll go to you. Hi, Dot.
Hi. I have a question about patchouli plant. Okay, I have patchouli oil I've had for years. I love it. I heard you can grow patchouli plants, but I want to know where to get them and if you have any more information on them.
Patchouli.
That's one of those plants that some people really like the smell of it, and I'm not one of those people. So... we have gotten them before in our, for down in our herb garden, and there's a couple, most of ours we order online because we typically have a wide selection of plants that we need that are kind of rare and unique. So, we order in mass because we, you know, have to get a lot of plants for the garden. So, some of our online sources, we use, strictly medicinal seeds, which I think is out of Oregon, Richter's herbs, which is out of Canada. So usually their shipping's kind of high. But locally, we haven't really looked for it. So I'm not, I can't give you an exact answer, but I did look it up online just to see what kind of shows up. And it looks like, you know, it shows up on Burpee's website. So, you know, depending on, you know, if you want to order something and have it shipped to you, or, you know, get an actual plant, you might have to do a little bit of looking online and calling around to see, you know, like what's available in your area. But it's pretty easy to grow. And I think it's probably those ones that if you keep it in a pot and give it enough light, you could probably bring it in for the winter and keep it going. So then that way you can kind of propagate it, you know, maybe buy cuttings and get more of it if you want. So, yeah.
Worth a try anyway. Sure.
Yeah, for sure.
Dot, good luck. Thank you. Listener called in, couldn't stay with us, but wanted to make a comment that they're very concerned about townships and counties mowing down the native plants that pollinators use along the roadsides. They're a fruit farmer, so they are really concerned or connected, I should say, to pollinators. You actually have a pollinator project going on, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's unfortunate that some municipalities do that because, you know, they're destroying habitat that they probably don't even know is habitat. So the Green Bay Botanical Garden, our director of horticulture, Mark Conluck, he's actually kind of heading this up. We are working with some other organizations within the community to create a pollinator corridor connecting the east and the west side of Green Bay through basically like a series of gardens throughout the city, so pollinators can kind of move between the different parts of the city and not be isolated little populations. So we know the importance of pollinators, and I think a lot of people are more aware at this point, but we've had two projects this summer that we planted over 6,000 different native flowering plants at two different locations in the community. So one of them on the west side of Green Bay, I think in June, they planted over 3,350 natives at Perkins Park. And then yesterday, they planted over 3,000 natives at Dan's Park at Century Grove on the east side of Green Bay. So all of those native plants we started from seed here at the garden this winter, grew them on into little, well, now they're actually pretty big plants. But we had all of about a dozen or so of our horticulture staff, and then about 20 to 30 staff from the Conservation Corps helped plant these perennials too, to make a pollinator garden that, you know, guests can go into those areas and see them. Yeah, it's pretty cool to get the plants out into the community and to kind of bring awareness to, you know, the pollinators. But, you know, kind of bringing that up, Larry, you know, a lot of places will do these pollinator gardens, prairie gardens, and they'll plant them and install them and then not do any maintenance after the fact. And, you know, if you don't kind of maintain these gardens the first couple of years when the plants are developing their root systems before they really take off. You know, a lot of weeds can come in, invasive species, and then they start to look weedy, or they do get weedy, and then people don't think they look good, or they don't know what they're looking at, and then they'll just mow it down because they'd rather see short, grassy looking stuff than, you know, all these weeds that are coming. So if anyone's wanting to do pollinator gardens, you know, meadows, that sort of a thing, you know, just know that it does take time and a lot of work to install and maintain to get it to look good. But usually after it's established, after like 3 or 4 years, you know, the weeds usually can't compete. But
yeah, for sure. Let's go indoors for a minute. Josh in La Crosse has to replace his hanging plants every year at his apartment. They're mostly in full sun all day. What do you recommend for flowers? Usually he has petunias in his pots.
Well, petunias are an annual, so they will need to be replaced every year. And especially if they're outside, you know, that might be the easiest way to change it up and have something different every year. But, you know, petunias are great, but if you're kind of over petunias, I'm a big fan of geraniums. There are a lot of different cool varieties you can get, and even some ivy leaf geraniums and varieties that trail down a little bit. What else do you use? There's different impatiens, actually, that are more tolerant of sun. The sunpatiens can take full sun to full shade. So I like to use those a lot because they can handle just about everything in a lot of different flower colors. Sweet potato vines are a nice trailer. And then you can add in, you know, there's so many different options. It kind of depends, you know, like what colors you want and, you know, what looks good. I mean, in the spring, early in the season, earlier in the summer when, you know, it's safe to plant things outside, I just go to my favorite nursery greenhouse and I just go and be like, okay, what looks good or what looks cool? And I just like buy a little bit of everything and then I just kind of design it on the fly and make it work. You know, if I know I need full sun, here's some plants that like full sun and I really like, and I just put them in a pot and I kind of let them go. So I feel like there's so many options these days. You can pretty much like drive yourself crazy trying to think of all the options, but
all good points. Alice emailed, this has to do with washing plants. Alice likes to put her plants outside if it's raining.
Yeah, I actually do that a lot too, Larry. As long as it's warm outside and it's not, you know, cold and frost. But in the summer, if there's like going to be a nice rainy day, not torrential downpours, I will bring a lot of my stuff outside and let it get saturated that way. And, you know, water from Mother Nature is better than anything you're going to get out of the tap because it doesn't have all the other stuff in it that we add to make the water clean, you know, and it's generally better for your plants. So, yeah, we like to do that here at the garden as well and at home too.
Yeah,
so,
I do it at home too. I've got some sitting on my front porch, and when it rains, I run out and put them out, and then they perk right up. Rainwater is good for sure.
And you don't get wet doing the same thing, Larry.
And you're good too, Lindsay. Thank you so much for spending some time with us today. I hope we can do this again.
Yes, for sure. Thanks for having me again. It's a pleasure. It's always great talking to you, Larry. Thank you.
Lindsay Hendricks, Horticulture Manager at the Green Bay Botanical Garden. Great to have her with us, and she'll be back. Coming up, we're going to talk mushrooms with the fun guy. That next. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us here for Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to switch our attention to mushrooms. You know, a lot of ways to grow mushrooms. I've done mushrooms on a log. I've done them in my home in the basement. I've tried it. You can do it in the bucket as well. Lots of ways to do it, and today we'll spend a little time talking about mushroom farming. And you're going to hear from a mushroom farmer, and you'll get some tips on cultivating your own edible fungi. Steve Schultz is our guest. He is the founder of Fun Guy Farm. I love that name. F-U-N hyphen, F-U-N space guy farm. Or I suppose we could call it Fungi Farm, Steve. He sells sustainably grown mushrooms in the Eau Claire area. And I tell you what, you want to know about growing mushrooms? Maybe talk about your favorites to eat? If you grow mushrooms, what are your methods? You can join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for having me.
I tell you what, I was on your site, your Fun Guy site, and I looked at how you got started in mushroom farming, which I thought was a pretty good story. So tell us that story.
Well, I had grown mushrooms on logs, shiitakes on logs, but how I really got started in my latest adventure here is my wife thought I was my memory was slipping. We were going to watch a movie on Netflix, and I picked one out. And she said, we'd seen that. I said, no, we hadn't. And we watched the trailer, and sure enough, we had. So, you know, I, not wanting to take any Prevagen or any other of those over-the-counter supplements, I did some research and found lion's mane was pretty good for mental health. And so I decided to grow lion's mane. And I was going to grow it like I grew shiitakes on logs. So I inoculated a couple logs, and it was going to be about a year before they were fully colonized, and I was going to get the fruits. And I thought, well, shoot, you know, by the time I get the fruits, I might forget where I put the logs. So I found a little better way, a little quicker way, growing them on sawdust, supplemented sawdust. And then pretty soon I had more mushrooms I knew what to do with. So I contacted Deidre Berrickman, as the manager of our local farmers market, our Eau Claire downtown farmers market. And I know she had grown mushrooms and sold them there for quite some time, but she had given that up and became the market manager. And she said, sure, we'd love to have a mushroom vendor again. And the rest is history. Short history.
Oh, but, man. Well, Ed, the Fun Guy Farm, I love the name. So what's the farm like? The farm like?
It's constantly evolving. It started out at the home farm where I was doing everything very manually, and I have a background in engineering, so I've been kind of bootstrapping and building more automated equipment. And today we are in about 1,200 square feet that consists of a lab, which is a HEPA filtered flow hood inside of a grow tent, because everything has to be, all the inoculation has to be done in a real sterile, clean environment. Then we have a sterilizer that will hold 480 pounds of substrate, about 68 pound bags. We have a mixer that I made out of a 250-gallon water tank, and I put I built my own mixer because, that's what I do. And it also has a bagger attachment, so we can fill the bags with the substrate. And it starts out, we mix up the substrate, we bag it up, we put it in the sterilizer. Once it's after it spends 24 hours at about 180 degrees, or gets to 180 degrees to sterilize the substrate, we bring it into the lab, and that's where I add the spawn and seal everything up. Then from there, it goes into about a third of our area is incubation. So we got roughly 400 square feet of incubation where it sits for 2 weeks, and the mycelium grows throughout the substrate. Then once it's fully colonized, we put it into our fruiting room, which is roughly the same size, and that's the nice area. That's because mushrooms have to grow at a cool 60, between 60 and 70 degrees, so that's where everyone on the farm wants to be. Only thing is, they also grow at about 80% humidity, so it's a little bit sticky in there.
Well, now, I'm sure you grow lion's mane, but what other mushrooms do you grow?
We grow lion's mane, oyster mushroom, several different kinds of oyster mushrooms, some pepini, a chestnut, and then seasonally we'll grow king trumpets, and we have a separate little refrigerated shack, if you will, for the king trumpets and black pearls in the summer season like this, because they like a cooler temperature. Yet they like to grow between 50 and 60, so they like it a little cooler. And and then in the winter time we will grow enokis and some of the cooler weather varieties. So we try to grow seasonally so that we can take advantage of the ones that like warmer temperatures in the summer, such as pink oysters and gold oysters, and then the cooler weather ones in the wintertime. That keeps our environmental, conditioning bills down, if you will. I don't want to, heat it up real hot in the winter, and I don't want to have to cool it down any more than I need to in the summer.
Makes a lot of sense. Well, how did that lion's mane turn out? I mean, can you remember things better now than you could before?
Oh, I have a mind like a steel trap, Larry. I attribute that to lion's mane. But we do, because of the medicinal quality of lion's mane, we started making tinctures as well. And I have so many customers that come up to me and give me testimonials on how it's really, really helped their mental focus and clarity and memory. And, I've been taking it for so long, I don't notice how well it's working until I don't have it. I was at a mushroom conference over in Door County, and I was giving a talk on the medicinal benefits of mushrooms. And once when I went over there, I didn't bring my lion's mane tincture with me, and I had the regular coffee from the bed and breakfast, and I was giving the talk, and I was just a little bit off, and I was like, what in the world's going on? I'm like, oh, yeah. Sorry, guys, I haven't had my lion's mane today. Here's my testimonial to how well it works.
Oh, boy. And you said coffee, and I saw that on your site. You make coffee out of it.
Yeah, we also make a coffee that we infuse. We make several different kinds of tinctures, but we infuse the coffee with lion's mane, chaga, and reishi tinctures, which we consider to be the three most medicinal of the mushrooms that we grow the lion's mane. The chaga is a foraged mushroom. It grows on live birch trees. And we have grown reishi in the past, but it grows so well out on hemlock trees in northern part of Wisconsin that we use foraged chaga and hemlock. We don't grow those anymore.
Gosh. I tell you what, this is a great operation you've got here. I was just going online to your site. I was surprised at the number of tinctures and so forth that you put together.
Yeah. Well, mushrooms have a medicinal component, obviously, and that's kind of what got me interested in growing them at any scale. But my production manager, she is a herbalist. She's an amateur herbalist. During COVID, she just decided to take up herbalism, and then she was buying lion's mane from me and making tincture out of it. And so I hired her, and she's been just a great, great addition to the farm. And then we got access to a commercial kitchen where we could make the tinctures and other products. So one thing just led to another. And then once I started getting the testimonials from people who have, who are using the tinctures, we can't quit now.
Chris and Adams couldn't stay with us. She takes some mushrooms for health conditions, and she's heard that it's best to cook them to get their benefits. Is that true?
That is true. Yeah. Mushrooms, the cellular structures of mushroom, the cellular walls are made of chitin. That's the same thing crab, crayfish, and lobster shells are made out of. And our bodies can't break that down very efficiently. But once you get to 160 degrees, it breaks that down for us where we can access the nutrients inside the cell walls. Now, it's a kind of a double-edged sword. At 190 degrees, they start breaking down. They start changing their structure, and they become less beneficial. So that's why when we make the tinctures, we're real careful to you know, run them at about 175 degrees, right in that sweet spot where we're breaking down the chitin and making it more bioavailable, and so we can get a full extract, and below the temperature where they're going to start breaking down.
Our guest today, Steve Schultz, is the founder of Fungi Farm. It's great to have him with us. And if you have some questions, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up Monday on the Larry Mueller Show, our physical therapists are back. This time they'll talk about the difference between doing physical therapy online versus in person. That's Monday at 11 on the show. Right now we're taking a look at mushrooms with our guest Steve Schultz, founder of Fungi Farms. And questions, give a call. 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. Love to hear from you. Is it difficult for the average person? I mean, you know, I've tried it. I've done it with logs. And, you know, I had some success. I tried it in the basement. I had a little bit of success there, but I wasn't as particular as I should have been, I think.
No, it can be as easy or difficult as you want to make it. You know, you can, like you say, you can grow on logs. You can plug a few logs, drill and plug the logs and put them someplace where in the shade where they're not going to dry out and have some success. You can just let them naturally fruit. Like say, take about a year for them to fully colonize. Then when it rains, that'll stimulate them to fruit. Or you can soak them, you know, you can soak them with a garden hose. You can go as simple as putting some wine cap spawn in amongst your hostas and your wood chips amongst your hostas, and that is usually very successful. Or there's other ones. Almond agaricus is one that you can put outside in your garden around the tomato plants, and every once in a while after rain, you'll get some really nice medicinal mushrooms. They're almond agaricus. Or you can buy blocks and fruit them indoors like I do. There's several ways
to do it.
Yeah.
Brad in Door County has something for us. Let's go there. Brad, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah. So I heard Steve say that his temperature is important in the summertime to keep cooler. And warmer, of course, than in the wintertime when he grows certain species. I was wondering if he's ever heard of an insulated concrete-formed building. I have a shop that's 10 foot tall, 100 foot long, 50 foot wide that's built this way, and it's still 56 to 58 degrees in the summertime, even when it's 90 and 100 out.
Insulated concrete buildings. Well, you're an engineer, Steve, so you probably know about them.
Yeah, that sounds excellent. I looked into is it insulated concrete or is it foamcrete? Is it aerated concrete but either way, any structure that you can keep cool. And I was using what I had available. Old warehouse space that I'm using, and that's just because it was available. But I am in the process of purchasing some used insulated refrigerated trailers. That anything that you can keep cool in the summer and heat in the winter efficiently, will work wonderfully. I was even offered a space in a basement building in Chippewa that has actually a natural spring running through it, and that would have been perfect. It's just a little bit too farther than I wanted to drive every day to pick mushrooms, because mushrooms have to be picked every day when you're growing them on a commercial scale.
Brad, there you go. Thank you for calling. Andy in Madison, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. I started outgrowing shiitake on logs, probably 30 years ago. And I'm just getting back into it and the economics of production. And just a couple questions. I'm going to rattle them all off. One, what substrate are you using for all your lignophiles and where do you get it? Two, are you creating your own bags that you're growing them in? So are you putting the injection port on? Are you putting the micropore filter on? So those are my questions.
Okay.
Yeah. I grow on a what they call master's mix. It's a mixture of 50% sawdust and 50% soybean hulls. A lot of people use hardwood fuel pellets for that, but I happen to be fortunate enough where I have a hardwood sawmill close by, and they deliver the sawdust. And then I also have, we're in an agricultural area, and so the soybean hulls are readily available. I also have them delivered. So yeah, it's a mixture. My substrate's a mixture of sawdust and soybean hulls, 50-50. And then by weight, it's 60% water and 50% of that dry mix. And then I purchase my bags. I purchase bags with the filter patch on them. I don't need an injection port because I don't use liquid culture. I buy my Grain Masters from Field and Forest in Peshtigo. They're a really good outfit to get any spawn or growing supplies from. But the injection ports for liquid culture, and I don't use liquid culture because I've gotten to the point where I'm trying to cycle stuff through faster, and if I use liquid cultures, I'd have to go with liquid culture to grain and grain to substrate, and it would just add more time to the process, which I'm right now, from inoculation to harvest it on my faster growing varieties like oysters, about 4 weeks. By going from a liquid culture, that would add another couple weeks to the whole process.
Well, there you go, Andy. Thank you very much for calling. Sarah in Sauk City, we turn to you. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I've got two questions for your guest. First one is, I've heard a lot of people say that you should only take mushroom supplements for a certain amount of time, something bad about taking them, long term. So I'm wondering if that is true. And then other question is about spent blocks at the farm. What do you guys do with your spent blocks, and do you ever give them out for free, or do you know of any farms that do that so us at home can get some extra fruitings?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the spent blocks, whenever someone wants spent blocks, they're free to take them because we dispose of them. Right now, they're going to the dump, and I feel like I'm actually contributing to some bioremediation by sending that myceliated substrate to the dump, and it helps clean up and remediate some of the materials at the landfill. And then as far as the mushroom supplements, there are certain ones such as chaga that have oxalates in it that can promote the growth of kidney stones if you're prone to kidney stones. Reishi is a mild blood thinner. So there are, it's not all upside on the tinctures. With any health supplement, though, you should always check with your doctor before you start taking any health supplements, whether it be mushroom or anything else.
Yeah. All right. There you go. And so those blocks, if Sarah wanted to come up, she could pick up some blocks.
Oh, certainly. She can pick up as many as she wants. I just right before I got on the air here, I just took out a whole, I don't know, it must have been about 400 pounds worth.
Sarah, there you go. And you can find, what's your website again? Just if you type in fungi mushrooms, you're probably going to get them, but.
You'll probably get it. Yeah, it's fungi, all one word, fungui-farm.com.
Fungi-farm.com. There we go. We have that up on our Larry Mueller Show page as well, under within today's notes. Garrett in Sturgeon Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Garrett.
Hey there. Thanks for talking to me. Steve, I caught you at Crossroads when you were here in Sturgeon Bay, so it was great to hear you then and pleasure to talk to you again now. So I'm selling mushrooms at our farmer's market here, and I was curious about your substrate mix, if you had to vary it from the master's mix for your enoki.
I really didn't. I was using the same master's mix, but you know, I'm not the world's foremost enoki grower. If you know of a better substrate mix, I'm all ears. I'm always learning. I'm a student of mushrooms. They teach me something every day, pretty much.
Garrett, have you got something different?
No, I haven't fruited any enoki yet, but I'm thinking about it here for the winter as well. So I just wanted to see if you had any variance there in the substrate, but good to know that master's mix works well for you.
Yeah,
I've had good luck with it. The best advice I can give you though is get a good culture, because I've had some enoki cultures that, you know, they'll incubate and the spawn run will be great, and then they just don't fruit. So the main thing is get a good viable culture from a good reputable source.
Garrett, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, one of the places you sell your mushrooms, as you said, was at the Eau Claire Downtown Farmers Market. What's your advice for people looking to sell mushrooms at a local market?
Well, I guess first thing is contact the local market manager. And you know, you can start small. You don't have to grow 300 pounds a week. You can get there. I'm living proof of it. But you know, you can start small, and a lot of the local markets, I think you'll be really surprised at how much attention the mushrooms will grab and how much draw there is for them. I certainly was. That's what got me to where I'm at now. I was really surprised at how much need there was in the community for fresh mushrooms. And then once people, you know, try fresh mushrooms, the store-bought ones just don't hold a candle to them, like any fresh food.
Yeah, and locally produced, it's all a good thing.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. The less miles they have on them, the better they are.
Well, any goals or dreams you have for Fun Guy Farm down the road?
Well, I did retire from my job of 28 years to do this, and someday I want to retire from this and get it to the point where it is running itself, where I'm not, you know, I'm. But like I say, every day I'm still learning, and once I can learn and get the processes standardized enough where I can hand it off to the next generation, if you will, then maybe I can truly retire. This mushroom farm is a lot of work.
How do you harvest them, by the way?
It's all by hand. It's all right now. I have my production manager. She's in there. It's just by hand. We just pull them right off the block, and then we trim any substrate that sticks to the base of the mushroom, and put them in a case, and then wheel them to the cooler. So it's a pretty simple process.
And how is the? I'm just curious. You have so many tinctures that you sell online. I'm just curious. Does that do pretty well for you?
Oh, it. Yeah, it does very well. And like I say, we have so many people that are, you know, have come to us and told us, you know, stories of how it's helped them. And then also they know what they're getting when they buy it from us, because we have it third party tested, and our testing agency bought 6 random samples from the Amazon, and 3 of them didn't have any lion's mane mushroom, lion's mane tincture, by the way, specifically, didn't have any lion's mane in them. One of them was, they couldn't tell if it was quite really lion's mane. 2 of them were legit. So You know,
you so do it legitimately.
Yeah, when our customers, and you're getting it local. And, you know, if it doesn't work for you, you can come back and give me grief in person.
Okay. Steve, a great pleasure. Thank you so much. Steve Schultz is the founder of Fun Guy Farms, Fun Guy Farm, I should say. Great to have him with us. Great to have our team, too. Joe Patnaud, Clara Neipert, our producers, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, our technical directors, Jill Nadeau, our executive director and everybody's boss, and I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening. Stay with us and have a great weekend.